Hi, y'all. It's Bridget Cutshaw with Real Things Living. Today, my guest is Jari Bolander, and he is an author and marketer. Can you say hi, Jari?
Hey everyone. Bridget, thanks for having me on the show.
I appreciate you connecting, and I think this is, guys, he's got a great story to share. He wrote a book called Ride or Die, Loving Through Tragedy, and it's a husband's memoir. And he's telling it from a perspective of a male caregiver, which most men don't talk about that. They hold it inside. And I'm so glad you're being vulnerable. And it's
Thank you so
important
much.
because, right, so many people are caretakers, but they only think of women. And they, right, seriously. And, but like, I'm still here because my husband was my caregiver for. Supported me. And so I really appreciate, and that's why I'm like very interested. He doesn't talk much. So I'm interested.
I'll talk for him, or I'll put words in his
Thank
mouth. How's
you.
that? He can read the book and tell me if I'm okay, if I
Exactly.
got it right or not, right?
Right. And that's why
Well,
I thought it'd be great.
yeah.
Revisit.
What's his name?
Carl.
Carl. Okay, Carl. So if I'm wrong, let me know. But I will be speaking for all male caregivers from
Right.
this point forward.
I call him Mr. C. I usually say Mr.
Mr. C. Okay,
Right.
Mr. C.
But yeah, you guys are very brave, and you got it's definitely men in general. The people think they're like aggressive, but you guys have natural resilience. You got to stand up, right?
Yes.
Is that the right word?
Yes.
You should say
Yeah.
natural, but.
Yeah, there's different skill sets, right? I mean, everyone is a full person. Like we may have dominant traits and we may have dominant, societal norms, but
Right.
we're all human and we all have those same emotions and fears
Yes.
and anxieties. It's just how we express them maybe differently. And that's one of the reasons I wrote the book was to give Carl and I a voice as to our shared struggle.
It's true. Everybody loves to hear stories, especially focusing on the takeaways and the negative things have happened, but you're sharing your takeaway and how you knew you had to take care of her, and you're still there, and you're still here, and
Yeah.
you're gonna share with us like what prompted you after your. I think your wife had leukemia, right? How long
That's correct. Yeah.
did that last? I'm just it's every
15 months from
wow,
diagnosis till she
that's
died. Yeah.
wow, that's
Yeah.
a short thing. I mean, I think,
Yeah.
and that's.
Yeah. 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 I mean, not we wish we had longer together, right? I think from the time we met till the time she died, we had known each other for 5.5 years. We were newlyweds when she got diagnosed,
Oh,
essentially.
wow.
So yeah, crazy, nutty. I mean, just like, when people say my life changed in an instant, the day she got diagnosed, my life changed in an instant. I thought that was all BS. And I'm like, oh my gosh, what am I gonna do? And what's interesting about caregiving, especially from a male perspective, is if actually if you look at some of the statistics nowadays, it used to be when you said, who's the caregiver, et cetera, generally 80-20, 80% women, 20% men, roughly, maybe a bit even in the teens. But nowadays, with the sandwich generation, Gen X, and your parents are aging, the sons are starting to take care of their family, their parents. And you start to see those statistics be a little bit more 50-50, some 60-40, 60% women, 40% men. So it's a real kind of coming up. And I think, when I was going through what I was going through, trying to take care of Jane and make sure that she got to all her appointments and got all the meds and all the chemo brain and all that stuff which she had, I'm sure Carl can relate as well. I really didn't find a lot of resources, a lot of male perspective. Not to say that there wasn't a lot of resources for caregiving, and there's a lot of books, mostly by women, a lot of memoirs, mostly by women, and I just sort of felt alone. I'm like, God, like how it's there's things that are similar, but then there's things that are really different, and I just wanted to put it out there, so that people knew, and if you love a man that's going through this, maybe you'll read it and be like, oh, I see what you're going through. How can I help? You know,
it's definitely important to make it, to normalize it. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't say normalize, but I think you kind of, it's more common than we think. Mm-hmm. And you're right. The my poor sons, I'm sorry. I only have sons, by the way. And maybe I was meant to have boys, but yeah, they were always wanting to be there for yeah. They're learning from their father. And our, right. Absolutely. And absolutely. I think that you want to be a positive role model. And I think you sharing your story in a book, definitely is, was it hard to do to write? Because that is, some people are so afraid to write and put it mm-hmm. out there. Mm-hmm. And, but it's can be cathartic for the readers. And it doesn't, you don't need millions of people to read your book. You just need just at least one. And then that you're influencing that person.
So yeah. I mean, for me, you know, I use writing to make sense of the world. So it's a natural thing for me to do. I can't fathom not writing my experiences down. I can't fathom not trying to synthesize it in some tangible form so that I don't, one, I don't forget it, and two, it becomes less scary, right? Because, you know, the way memory and trauma and grief and sorrow work, it's a memory process that as you repeat over time, you remember things differently because your memory doesn't work. It's not just a snapshot. It's the feelings and emotions as you remember over time, right? So I started writing this book the day she died. Like the first, a chapter in there that I just started writing because I had to. I didn't know what else to do. You know, what do you do when you see your wife being zipped up in a body bag and taken off on a ratty gurney into a white van to go to the mortuary. I had family there, her family was there, but when this all occurred, they took a walk around the block and it was my responsibility to make sure that she was taken care of. And I mean, it was just surreal. Like we're in our apartment. This was on, you know, April 3rd, 2017. You know, it was a nice day. People are just living their lives. And my life has completely changed again in an instant. And I remember sitting there, you know, very cordial. The funeral home staff's very cordial. And they're talking me through the process. You know, the fire department had come before, the coroner had come before. It was a whole mess. And I just remember, you know, she's laying in our bed. You know, she's been gone for, I don't know, 8 hours or so. And I'm sitting there like, I don't know what to do. Like, it's, you know, like, how am I supposed to act? You know? And I just remember sitting in the living room and they had zipped her up and they put her on the, you know, the gurney and they're going to wheel her out of my apartment or our apartment. And they're like, you don't have to be here for this. You can wait outside. You can, you know, this is sometimes very emotional. And I took a deep breath and I'm like, well, you know, I need to see her off proper. Like I need to, like, this is my last, as a husband, this is not one of the last things, but this is sort of my responsibility.
Right.
So yeah, I followed them out behind her gurney and as they, you know, went down the stairs and they had this nondescript white van. Like, I think it was an Astro, it was some like Ford Aerostar van. I don't even remember what it was. Opened the door and, you know, rolled this gurney in, shut the door, and they looked at me and they're like, we'll be in touch. And then they drove away.
Oh, wow. And you're by yourself, right? At that moment, right?
But this is the thing. You know, we lived in San Francisco. We lived right across the street from a hospital. It's 11, it's noon time. You know, it's a decently busy night. And I'm sitting there on the, like, on this curb, watching this van go away and then looking around and there's people just living their lives. Like, to them, it's just another day. To me, this is the most catastrophic day of my adult life to date. Like, my wife's died.
Right.
She's gone. Like, I'm alone. I'm literally alone. No one's around me. I just sat there. Like, what do I do? Yeah. Right.
I can't imagine that. Right.
Yeah. I ended up going back in the apartment because I was going to collect some clothes and go stay at her parents' house, my in-laws' house. And I remember grabbing her pillow that she laid her head on and screaming into it as hard as I could, just crying and screaming. I just don't know what else to do. And then I must have done that. It felt like eternity. It was, I don't know, 5 or 10 minutes. And I took a deep breath and I pulled out my laptop and I started writing. And that eventually became the book.
Wow. I mean, that's a brave of you to share that moment.
Well, it's in the book too. Yes.
I haven't had to experience that myself. I mean, my stepfather died at home, but he's a lot older, right?
Yeah.
So it's a little, yeah. You guys are in your 30s, right?
Yeah, she was 36. I was 46. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I didn't know the age difference, but that's right. Wow. That's all I can say. And did you stay in that apartment? Or did you?
So for the first 3 days, I didn't.
Okay. Right. That would be traumatic.
What, yeah. When I went back, I slept on the couch until I bought a new bed.
Mm-hmm.
I ended up staying in that apartment for three more years, roughly 3 or 4 more years. It's ironic. The reason I had to leave, I wasn't looking to do, you know, move or whatever, but one of the things that happened was I had a fire. My, battery backups that most people have, they're called universal power source.
I don't know, you've
probably heard of them. I had one of those plugged in, it caught on fire in my living room. So I woke up at 2 a.m. to smoke alarms and smoke. I went out and I'm like, my living room's on fire. Like, holy shit.
Crap.
Yeah. And I guess it's time to leave. So that's why I moved. I wasn't looking to move. People had told me you should move on, move someplace else. I'm like, I was lazy. And if you think of folks, if you want to, if you believe in the afterlife and signs, probably having a fire in the apartment you shared with your dead wife is probably a sign you should move. So I moved.
If you think of it that way, that's kind of. It was, I don't know if I could go back into, that's why I was asking you. I don't know if I could go back in there just because, I don't know.
Well,
you did.
I mean,
it.
Yeah. Well, and also there's a lot of love there too, right? Like one of the things it wasn't tragic. I mean, it's tragic, but it wasn't tragic. Like there was just a lot of love there. And I think part of what I wanted to do was, you know, that's where she was. Like, so I wanted to kind of keep that close. You know, I mean, we ended up like getting rid of all of her stuff, like, you know, what you know.
That's hard, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's hard. And I had friends and family to help me out. But it's like, I just wanted to be there. I wanted to be close, you know, and it was just, it wasn't really weird for me, right? This wasn't really weird for me. You know, having a fire in your living room and getting woken up at 2 a.m, that's traumatic and scary and a sign.
Those are 3 points.
Get your shit together. Let's go.
You definitely have something like that tragedy, both, I think both of them are tragic, especially the fire is you need to learn you had to move on and find, is that the right word? In some shape or form.
Yeah. I mean,
it's so what do you, obviously the journey for you to write this book was healing, it sounds like. Mm-hmm. How long did it take you to finish that book? I'm just curious.
It took about five and a half years to finish and publish.
Right,
Wow.
It does, people don't realize how long it takes.
Well, if you want to write a good book, yeah.
Yeah, to do a
I mean,
good
you're in
book.
The publishing industry, you know.
Right.
I had various drafts of it done a year, 2 years after. I mean, actually a year. I had done something called NaNoWriMo. And NaNoWriMo is, you know, National Write a Novel in a Month. Well, I decided to write a memoir in a month. And so I had a draft of it, but it was horrible. Not horrible. there was a thread in there. There was something among the nonsense, or something among the there was something there. And I'd worked on it and had editors and worked on it. And, you know, I wasn't writing the whole time. You know, if you know anything about, I mean, obviously, you know about the writing process. But for those of you that don't know about the writing process, it's this annealing process. It's like you write something, you think about it, then you get to make it better. And there's a span of time because you're so close to it, you can't see the problems. That's why you have to have a good editor. That's why you have to have time. And you have to let it anneal, and you have to let it maturate over time. It's like it marinates, you know, I don't know, for lack of a better word.
Right.
And it just took me a while to maturate it. And it took me a while to find a good editor. You know, I've had really good editors, like lots of friends. And then I found a great publisher in Spark Press, and I'm just like, oh yeah, Brooke Warners. She's the one. You're going to tell me how to make this better and you get me? Oh, A+, let's go. Like, come on, you know?
Right. You're very brave just to start this process and make it publicly. And people,
thank you.
I think during COVID, I noticed more books were published, mm-hmm. which is a good thing. People are like, you know, there's only so much time here left. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. that's kind of how you saw that. And
yeah,
I love the perspective that you're taking. You are the male caregiver. And so to kind of hop back to that, before she passed away, how, you said it's like 18 months she was dealing with.
Yeah, 15.
You had to do a lot of, was she able to drive herself, or you had to take her? I'm just curious. No?
No, it was pretty much full-time caregiver and full-time running her business, which
wow, you had a business on top of it.
Yeah, that's the only thing that was keeping us, you know, in double espressos and orange scones. we didn't have, I mean, you know, she wanted to keep it. I wanted to shut it down, but it was her baby. And so we compromised that I would run it, you know, and it's just so, you know, as from the male perspective, or, you know, as a stereotypical male behavior, right? We want to perform, we want to achieve. We have this high achievement, high, like, I am my work. I am what I do. I am who I am, right? So, you know, I wanted to do good, and I wanted to do good on two very complex things. One, running a business I had no clue what to do. And second, how do I be the best caregiver I can be and make sure that she survives, and like,
right,
get through it, right? So when you're a doer, when your self-worth is wrapped up in what you do, you tend to work really hard. My whole life has been working hard. Like, that's how I identify, like, oh, you know, I'm an entrepreneur. You know, we work, you know, 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's just what you do. Suck it up. Like, I'm Gen X. That's just what we did.
I'm a Gen Xer too.
right. Like, yeah, like, the cavalry is not coming to help us. We help ourselves. So I was always doing, achieving, and I really didn't have the perspective of the emotional toll it was taking on her and it was taking on me. And I was hesitant to ask for help. I thought I could handle this. I couldn't handle it. Clearly, it was just too much. Thankfully, we had a bunch of friends and family, and that we created this care circle called Team Jane. And even though I didn't ask a lot, they were there. So I knew that they were there, but I just didn't know how to ask for help, which is a common male trait.
Like, right.
I don't need directions. I'll figure it out, you know?
I'm a do-it-yourselfer. I'm a deep, right?
Exactly. Come on. It's in our DNA. It's like barbecuing meat, you know, and getting to the directions, you know, whatever. Like, walk it off, right? And so as a caregiver, especially for someone with a life-threatening disease, you lose yourself in that. I think all caregivers do, because everyone cares about the patient. They don't people cared about me, quote unquote. I'm not going to say that. But the first thing they'd say is, how's Jane? It was rare to say, how are you doing? Which is valid, because the most important thing is, let's get Jane cured. And so, you know, when you mix all those things together, you get a severe amount of burnout. I abused substances to sleep. Like, I would smoke pot all the time just to sleep. I would drink alcohol, which thankfully now I'm sober, been sober almost, I'll be 6 years in May. So
awesome.
Yeah, thank you. And so the you know, I appreciate you saying, you know, you have the courage to tell your story. And I sometimes am apprehensive about saying how much courage it really is, because really who had the courage was Jane. I was really committed. I was committed to her. But as I talk with people like you, and people have been very thoughtful and really supportive, and just, I'm blown away by how many people just enjoy the book. I think the courage part is it's starting to have some more meaning to me. And I think what I'm starting to realize is that the courage I have is the courage for all male caregivers to tell our story. And hopefully that gives someone else the chutzpah or the, you know, the comfort to be like, yeah, I can tell my story too. Yeah, this was tough on me. So I'm sure Mr. C, Carl.
Yeah, Mr. C, yeah, the courage thing you learned, I guess, to help build your resilience. You know what I'm saying?
Well, I mean, what's interesting about resilience, right, is to me, it's being able to handle uncomfortable situations with grace and poise and figure it out. Yes. So a lot of people, when they run into a problem, a zig and a zag, they shut down. They don't know how to handle it. And when you're resilient, you're like, okay, take a knee, take a breath. How do I deal with this? I've never seen this before. I don't know what I'm doing, but what's the first step? And the people that do that figure it out. The people that go in their little private pity party and I get almost, they just can't function. Those are the ones that lack the resilience to handle it, right? And so thankfully I had a lot of experience in endurance athletics, a lot of experience in the startup world. I was trained to zig and zag. I was trained to be comfortable being uncomfortable. I was trained to not give up. That inherent in my DNA through all of the stuff I've done, right? So to me, resilience was, I trained for it. It was no surprise.
Right.
It was no surprise that I stepped up and did what I did. Now, I didn't know how to do it. I didn't know if I could sustain it. But I knew, like, when she got diagnosed, I'm like, okay, my first thought is we need to prioritize and execute how we're going to solve this problem. There was no debate in my mind we were going to cure her. There was no debate in my mind I could figure it out. And I'm going to make sure that, you know, Team Jane's going to survive, or Team Jane's going to win, because we're going to make sure the MVP survives, right?
Right.
There was no doubt. In fact, there was no doubt until the week before she died. Like, I'm like, okay, what do we got to do? There were times during that whole time where I was worried that she may die. And, you know, a bunch of times I broke down and just cried alone. I just couldn't handle the emotions, were just so overwhelming. I'm like, I'm either going to drink myself into a stupor, or I'm either going to go run, or I'm going to sit in this corner and just let it out so I can actually function, you know? And I think those are the things that, you know, women caregivers tend to show more of that, I would say. I mean, maybe some male caregivers do, but generally from a societal perspective,
right, it's
what's the predominant paradigm, right?
I think it's every society, kind of, not just our American culture, right? It's maybe because physically men are usually stronger, so they're expected to be quietly strong. It's kind of, you know what I'm saying, you're not showing your emotions as much, and usually men don't. And
yeah,
is it stoicism? Maybe think of the word stoic.
Well, yeah. And I think, so what's interesting about the Stoics, you know, I've read a little bit about that. And it's not that they weren't emotional. It's not that they didn't share feelings. It's not that it was just, there was context, right? What they were trying to do is all of these barriers in the way, the obstacle is the way, like, this is just part of life. Don't get bent out of shape about it. Just deal with it.
Right.
You could still share authentic emotions. And as a man, there are times where that's appropriate. And there are times that that's not. Like, if someone's shooting at you or you got to run out of a burning building, it's not the time to have emotion. It's time to act. But when you're in a safe environment with people you love and you're like given the eulogy for your dead wife, it's okay to share some emotion because that's emotional. And that's exactly what happened when I did that. Like, I just had to, take a moment, like, you know, her urn is there on this table, you know, she got cremated and I'm sitting there saying the eulogy for a 36-year-old woman who shouldn't have died, you know, and I'm in a room full of 250 people that all love me and loved her. I'm going to show some emotion because I'm in a safe place. There's no one shooting at me. I don't have to act. I just have to, you know. So I think that's what we lack. I think that's what we miss. We, as men, I think we don't think sharing emotion is manly, or I don't think we don't know the correct context. Because, you know, when I used to drink, you know, we're with a bunch of buddies and we're all getting drunk. We're all like loving and crying and laughing and saying, I love you. We're sharing the emotion, but it's because we're in a safe environment. We're, you know,
right.
And we're all drunk.
We're all drunk. And that's, to me, I think when you are drinking, your true personality comes out. Is that the right word?
Well, yeah, in some cases, I think you're right. Well, that the inhibition goes away.
When he has been drinking, he's a happy guy. So there you go. I shouldn't say happy, but nice. So that's kind of what I was kind of implying. I mean, about the personality. He is deep, a really nice person.
Yeah.
But he just doesn't, he's just quiet.
I mean, my dad was the same way, right?
That's how my husband is a quiet guy. He's going to kill me talking about that. I'm kidding.
No, but I mean, look.
Yeah, I think it's good. And you had also made me think of how you got to own your narrative too, as a man or a woman, how you owning your narrative on your journey. And I love that, I should say perspective, but it's good. Own it and be you, but still be kind, right?
Yeah. I mean, if you look at like one of the most, they talk about it a lot, like the warrior culture, like the warrior poet or the samurai is an example. The most universal trait of a samurai, a well-respected samurai, is compassion. And if you read all about their society and what they did, you would notice that they had a lot of arts and letters. They had a lot of poetry and art. They were also very deadly, and they used the deadly force when needed. It was that they were the full, like I like to think that, the warrior poet idea, or what I call the intellectual knuckle dragger, as the, I mean, it's, I, as a man, can harness violence when required, but also be compassionate to those that I need to help. And you see this all the time. Like, you see some of the most scary looking people on the planet helping, you know, kids, or like, there's this one group that's a bunch of bikers that support kids that have been abused. So when they have to go to court, so they're not intimidated, there's like 100 bikers that, you know, like this, like, you are not going to intimidate this kid. We're going to intimidate you. That's a compassion thing. That's a show of strength thing. That's being able to harness the violence and the aggression in a positive way. And, you know, we hear about this, you know, people tend to talk about toxic masculinity and the patriarchy and all these things that are just sort of missing the point. You know, that's true. There's some of that. And I think we have to be respectful, right? But we also have to be compassionate, because when you look at the statistics, men and boys aren't doing great, right? More suicides, more disconnection. There's all these things that are just not going well. And to say that that's the patriarchy or they deserve it or they're toxic,
right.
That you would never, if you were to reverse, if you were to, you know, the symmetry of that, if you were to say that about women or about other minority groups, you would be chastised. So have some compassion. I mean, come on.
Correct. I think, right, the what we're expecting or kids expecting, they're not, we didn't have the social media. I'm sorry, I'm going on different path. We didn't have the social media stuff to deal with. And I laugh about the first phone I had was at a mini briefcase. Okay.
Yeah.
And that
or it was like literally bolted into the car.
Yeah. And it was, this was like, oh shoot. My first one was probably 25 years. I don't know, 25 years ago. And it's all good. But I think that helps too. I think we let be you. And I love the perspective that you mentioned about the masculinity and the compassionate side. And I feel safer around that environment. So I guess because I was raised around the military. I'm a military brat.
Mm.
So I've always been safe, Jari, because I've had these men protect you all the time.
Yeah.
Unknowingly, I used to get mad at my brother. I'm just going down a different, like, why won't people ask me out? Because I know who my brother is. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. I was in high school. I'm like, oh.
Yeah.
But he's such a nice guy, but then guys do, don't mess with her brother.
Yeah.
Or mess with
Yeah.
And that's kind of an example. And I think
I
appreciate that now, being around that environment.
Yeah.
I was very lucky.
Yeah, no, I mean, as was I. I mean, you know, I have a bunch of friends that are in the military. We would work out a lot together. It was a community of folks, both men and women, but they had this common goal of excellence and performance and camaraderie and esprit de corps, you know, that bonded us together. And it was like, we got your back. And, you know, the military, I think, is one aspect of that where, you know, you don't have that, people die. Like, it's pretty cut and dry, right? Like, you know, it's an environment where the stakes are high.
Yes.
And nowadays, this, you know, social media and people getting canceled and piling on and, you know, all these just crazy things, the stakes are low for you to be an asshole, just full stop.
That's a good point.
If you were face to face with someone, this is how I think of it. Anytime I interact with, like, if I'm face to face with this, what would I say to this person's face?
You'd be more careful, probably.
Yeah. Because, like, to your point, your brother or your father or your whatever, the threat of retaliation or the negotiation, as it was, so to say, it's like, you mess with her, you mess with me.
Yes.
Okay. Like, there's a check and balance there. That's not the case on social media, right? That's
correct. It's not that you don't have that check. You know, people aren't, I don't know. I'm opinionated, but I try not to put my opinion out there too much because, you know, you just don't, people are going to be negative about it. And I was just thinking too that, oh, how brave. I'm just go back to my husband. My stepfather was a company commander. Okay. And I went to college and my husband was in that company. He didn't know.
Wow.
I officially figured out I was the step daughter, but you were brave asking me out. But my stepfather liked them because I didn't appreciate the at that time. I was like, oh God, you guys are so masculine. That's kind of how because I was around, you know what I'm saying? But I'm so glad everybody in that environment, I have full respect for people in the military and those who are like police and they're risking their lives to help everybody.
For us. Yeah. I mean,
I'm going off on a tangent here. Sorry.
No. Well, I think it comes full circle in terms of that's a different kind of caregiving. Right.
That's kind of what it. They're
taking
care of our country, our city, their community, and that's why I couldn't. Being a, you know, I don't know if I could. That's why I'm very brave, and I have full respect. And you wrote this beautiful book, and I really like your perspective on stuff. The stuff you're bringing up, it's very you're a philosopher
Intellectual knuckle dragger is what I like
right,
to say.
You are. I love that. I think
True. I mean, you could be the warrior poet or the intellectual knuckle dragger. And I think as men, we have to own that. I think we have to own the narrative around what a man is, because we're men and we should own the narrative. No one else should tell us. I don't tell a woman that's not me, right? That's not my purvey. I need to own the narrative. We as men need to own the narrative, and that narrative needs to include compassion. It needs to include understanding. It needs to include strength. It needs to include respect. And we've lost that because I think a lot of times young men and young boys are like, oh, you're toxic. Masculinity is toxic. You're like, then what the hell am I? I mean,
right. And where did
I'm born this way? What am I supposed to do? I can't.
You're born
it's hard
that way.
For me.
Right. And I'm a little wild compared to some of my friends because I had an older brother who raised me. Okay. So I'm not wild, but I think that's, we were Gen Xers and free roamers, right? Yeah. I grew up in the 70s and I had an older brother watch me. So you can, I wanted to be just like him. Yeah. And of course I'm like a lot smaller, but I'm glad I was around that environment. So that's probably why I understand that. And I have a different perspective, and that's why I pause when I'm in a situation on how I'm going to react. Try not to react. Right.
Yeah. I mean, try living in the San Francisco bubble. I mean, where sometimes, so what's interesting is I have this newfound appreciation for people with different opinions. I think in the marketplace of ideas, in the intellectual combat, so to speak, of the world, the only thing we have is respect for others' ideas. So I've become more and more thoughtful and more compassionate on someone that doesn't agree with me. This was not the case 5-6 years ago, right? I've evolved, I guess. And I think we have lost that when it comes to the no consequences and repercussions of our interactions on the web. And I think why this matters, and getting back to the book and talking about being a male caregiver and talking about the struggles and challenges and sharing the journey and really just trying to shed light and showcase the real struggle that is the story that, I mean, it's my story, it's Jane's story, it's to a certain degree Carl's story, that if we don't have that intellectual honesty and that intellectual debate, and we don't assume good intention on the other side, and we just don't talk about these things, just going to keep on going down the bad path. And I just don't think that's the right way to go. I've never seen that end well. So,
yeah. Right. We definitely need to have more respect and compassion for each other.
100%.
That is what we're learning from you, a caretaker. And it's so important. I'm sorry we got off a little bit off tangent, but that's, you just don't know. And you're, what you call yourself, a knuckle dragger?
Intellectual knuckle dragger.
Intellectual. I love that, because that's good. We need to have that. You're very respected, I'm sure, where you are, because you're being open and authentic. And I think that's the kind of people we need more of, because you'll have an effect on, you know, those around you in the world. And you want it to be like a domino effect, to be positive. Yeah. I'm fully believer of focusing on the positive, right? And expecting the good is what my stepfather always taught me to expect. He was a badass. Okay. He was the special forces and all, but he always taught me expect, you know, that's what I learned from him in reflection, not at the time.
Of course.
But I think writing helps you figure that out.
And absolutely. Just
sharing your story. Well, this has been awesome. So where can the listeners learn more about you?
The book's on Amazon, Barnes and Noble, bookshop.org. If you're into independent bookstores, as Jane and I were, so you can order it there. I've got my own website, jarrybolander.com. It's got all my writing and stuff on there. I'm pretty active on LinkedIn. So if you're on LinkedIn, Jarry Bolander on there, pretty straightforward. My name's pretty unique. And yeah, I mean, I really appreciate the time. I love the conversation, and it's really important to me to have these conversations, and you're a very thoughtful, insightful host, and that's much appreciated. And I'll just say, good job, Carl.
He helped calm me down. Just kidding.
No,
we calmed each other down. Trust me.
Yeah, 100%.
His parents thanked me. They said I calmed him down.
It is not lost on me the power of a great partner, and I have a great partner now, and my fiance, and I just,
bliss. We're the opposite. That's kind of what we're not too similar, but anyway, well, for those that are listening, I will include the links you mentioned in the description, and I thank you again for your time, Jarry. This has been awesome, and very insightful.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
All right. Have a great day, everybody.